we have obviously in a post 9/11 world have become far more aware of the role and value of someone that can handle chaotic situations in an organization, whether it be public or private.
Yeah.
And that's the value.
Yeah. I think what this meeting is also kind of highlighted is that the response community is a little smaller than I think we all think it really is, as far as like with real expertise.
That was part of the conversation about how many people are actually trained and active hazardous material technicians. I have hazmat tech training. Others have had that. That doesn't mean we've used it or that we respond to things on any regular basis. So true hazmat teams with that functional capability to respond this moment with the right tools, the right training, and the right resource is a little bit thinner than some thought.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. It's time to spread the word about this podcast. If you're just tuning in for the first time, well, welcome. We are honored to have you here with us. Please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast and leave a review about this episode. If you are a longtime listener, well, thank you. If you haven't gone to my website lately, please sign up for our newsletter, blog posts, and email announcements. And do it now. Go to www.seankgrady.com. That's www.seankgrady.com. And become a member of the ET Nation today. We look forward to having you join us.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady, and today's guest is Anthony Mangieri. Anthony is the professor of the Emergency and Disaster Management at Rowan University and also at the American Military University. And he's also the regional president of the International Association of Emergency Managers. And I'm glad to have Anthony here at the Rail Hazmat Leadership Summit and participating. And thanks for coming on and agreed to do an interview.
Of course.
So Anthony, why don't you, for the listeners, tell us a little bit about what you do, what your background is, and how you got, you know, involved with emergency management.
Sure. So what I bring to the table in this discussion is both a local flavor as a former town manager and emergency manager. My main role is to help to add to the discussion the local perspective and local input into these issues. As far as responsibility, besides teaching, I do emergency plans and training around the country focused on natural hazards, technological hazards, man-made, homeland security type events, and help communities understand and become informed as to their planning process.
Wow. So are you helping communities actually develop and write their plans?
Yes. And mainly focusing on hazard risk reduction, threat hazard assessment, what is called hazard mitigation, but it's all risk management or risk reduction.
If you could, for the listeners a bit, walk us through that risk assessment process, general high levels. It doesn't have to be super detailed, but because some people may go, what do you really mean, Anthony, and how do you do this?
So there are many people in the community in emergency management. The first rule, in my view, of emergency management is you have to understand the threat and build a threat profile, build and understand what the risks are to the community, understand how those risks might impact the community, and then build a strategy out for what resources are needed to respond to and effectively recover from crisis.
Okay, so you're helping them identify their exposure risks or where their areas of, I won't say opportunities, but areas that they're susceptible to have catastrophic events or
it's all about building a resilient community. So you're hitting the right words and saying areas of both threat and opportunity for reducing risk and vulnerability to the community. It may be as simple as a policy discussion or updating codes and standards, and more complex, moving severely repetitive loss properties that are constantly inundated and flooded because they're in high hazard areas, helping those residents get out of harm's way.
Yeah, that's interesting. Identifying those susceptible areas that continue, like you said, flood or something like that, or maybe fire hazards. What are some of the stakeholders you're talking to when you get involved with this type of planning assessment?
Absolutely. Thank you for reminding everyone. It is not just floods. While flood is a majority hazard, We're also talking wildfire in that interface area, especially along national parkland or national forest. It really, the stakeholders are multifaceted. You want a whole community approach. You want to talk to the local constituents. You want to talk to the electorate, and you want to talk to the emergency managers and the residents to understand the total dynamic of risk and vulnerability, what's acceptable and what's not. You certainly can't go into a community and recommend something that is totally unacceptable for the community, for whatever cultural or historical or social value to the community. You have to keep those things in mind as well.
So you're touching on environmental justice a bit there. So that sounds like it's an area that you focus on when you're doing this assessment.
Absolutely. Environmental justice, considerations of the community as a whole, also understanding under-resourced populations and how they can have access to these programs as well, has to be a critical part of the discussion.
So when you're working with communities, are you helping them also connect the dots between some of the service providers that are available to them in the industry or resources available to them to access to be more prepared?
It depends on the scope of the plan. But yes, if I'm doing a disaster recovery plan, then certainly you label out the potential resources based on the threats that might be faced or the potential impacts that might be felt. If you're doing just a hazard analysis, then you want to identify the threats and vulnerabilities, and then the community will work towards. It depends on what phase you're at and what plan or strategy you're putting together.
Okay. All right. So you've been invited here to participate in the RAIL Hazmat Thought Leader Summit. Let's talk about your involvement in that aspect of emergency response.
So as far as this event and this activity, it's an interesting connection. I certainly have way too many years as a volunteer firefighter and involved at a local level and know many of the players here from a variety of events, unfortunately.
More fortunately, I think.
The reality is that while not a hazmat operator, not someone that actively responds to hazardous material incidents, what I do bring to the conversation is the perspective of local government. What are the local town managers thinking? What are the priorities at that local most level that sometimes gets overlooked because we're very focused on response and remediation? We sometimes need to pause and look at how it's affecting the municipality as equally vulnerable, the entity itself, budgets and response and recovery long-term.
Yeah, the impact of the event to the municipality and how maybe catastrophic it could be. Maybe a bridge goes up. Yesterday, Port of Maryland's bridge fell.
And that's
a huge issue.
Absolutely. And economically, that impact to the city, to county, and to that region is going to be catastrophic for quite a while. It can take, I've heard, anywhere from 8 to 18 months to just get the debris and reopen those channels.
Yeah, we're talking 2 years probably before anything really gets resolved or
all those
a new
workers,
bridge.
Yeah. All the people. So the economic impact of what we do, it can be fairly comprehensive. And it's not a minor discussion. You got to make sure the right people are in the room to have the right conversation, which is a big part of facilitating this effort.
So when you're involved, you're trying to identify those stakeholders that should be at the table to address these types of catastrophic events, and you have it built into your plan. Is that
accurate? The ideal. That's the ideal. Not all jurisdictions understand all the players that should be there or could be there. In some cases, it's the systems are set up, the social justice and the social support systems are set up maybe at a county level, and you're trying to bring the municipality into that realm and dynamic. So you have to be very conscious of the dynamics of what's going on, who the players are, and who the support systems are, so that you build those relationships ahead of time. Obviously, if you're waiting to when a disaster occurs, you're already a day too late.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. We'll be right back after this message. This podcast is sponsored by Enthalpy Analytical. Enthalpy Analytical is a national network of accredited laboratories and your single source for comprehensive environmental testing services. Their team of scientists, industry specialists, project managers, and analysts have decades of experience in supporting the testing needs of public sector, private industry, and governmental agencies. Their services include testing of water, soil, sediment, air, tissues, and products for hazardous compounds, including but not limited to organics, metals, pesticides, PCBs, dioxins, and PFAS.
Enthalpy Analytical is your trusted source for all your analytical data needs. To learn more about Enthalpy Analytical, check out their website at www.enthalpy.com.
So from the rail perspective, what are you dealing with at the community level with the class ones? Are you doing the initial engagement on behalf of the community you're serving or helping them assist in the communication connection and handoff, or what are you doing?
One of the major takeaways that I have from the last couple of days here is that when we do a threat hazard assessment, or called a THIRA, when we look at the potential harm that could happen to a community, I generally ask for records of hazardous material releases and impacts in a community. What I don't necessarily or haven't necessarily done is done railway studies of what's going through the community. This is going to change that in my view, in that I'm now going to research what that corridor is carrying as part of the conversation. So it is part of learning what resources are out there for me to make a better threat profile or assessment. I don't want to call it a threat because obviously if the rail runs clean and there's no incidents, there's no history. But if there's a potential risk, I need to know about it.
Yeah, that's basically you helping identify, the risk in that assessment. That's really good. Now, we've talked a lot about preparedness and training of emergency responders. Do you get involved with that aspect of the preparedness plans that you're working with municipalities on? And if so, what are the challenges with keeping that going and maintaining?
So if you're following the process of emergency management as a system, the first thing we do is that threat hazard identification. Then we prepare a plan. The next step is to do a series of workshops or orientation, tabletop, functional, and full-scale exercises. Uh-huh. So we do these exercises to test the plan and say, all right, this worked, this didn't work, this is reasonable, this is not reasonable, or to find whatever surprise might show up.
Sure.
And, that is why the exercising becomes so valuable. Uh-huh. If it's done, it will identify the gaps that are necessary for jurisdictions to look for resources to build and improve resiliency or capability to effectively respond.
Okay. All right. What are some of the observations that you've seen here at the conference that you go, wow, okay, I didn't anticipate this scenario being an issue? Because one of the things, the takeaways I've seen is that, or learned here, is that it's a complex issue of dealing with training and readiness of responders and having communication between all the stakeholders. And what's some of the takeaways you've learned here?
Every after action review I've ever done starts with communication issues. And this was no different.
Yeah.
We were left after 2 days with a strong feeling like we're not communicating effectively with each other.
I would agree with that.
The second thing that I noticed was, contrary to maybe some people's opinion, the railway industry is not saying stay away. They're saying, let's do this, but let's do this efficiently. And that's right. It's legitimate to want to spend money, but spend it in a way that gets the best results.
Right.
And the third thing I think for me has been the discussion that we had about local emergency planning councils, their role, functionality, and the fact that even though we're 30 years into this or so of building local emergency planning committees and all of these things, they are not consistent across the country.
Right.
Some are very active. Some are not. Some are utilizing their enforcement authority. Some are not. I think that I'm left as an academic wanting to go back and research more about LEPCs and start to train and orient how local emergency managers can build what in essence is their board of directors and their force multiplier to getting into the community and getting that resiliency that we keep talking about.
Yeah. I also heard a theme in the meetings that I participated in where the challenges with maintaining staff retention. Are you seeing that in your work, in your line of work too?
I do see, especially in the consulting world, because it's always a dynamic of moving, but I see a lot of young adults wanting to come into this profession. And I think that's fantastic. It adds a diversity of thought and an exchange of ideas and a maturing of ideas over time. Statistically, emergency management, which is a very general category in labor statistics, has been growing by about 3 to 7%, depending. And that's both public, private sector across the board.
Uh-huh.
So I think the industry is growing as far as crisis managers. And I think the educational requirements are increasing.
Uh-huh.
But overall, I think that we have obviously in a post 9/11 world have become far more aware of the role and value of someone that can handle chaotic situations in an organization, whether it be public or private.
Yeah.
And that's the value.
Yeah. I think what this meeting has also kind of highlighted is that the response community is a little smaller than I think we all think it really is, as far as like with real expertise.
That was part of the conversation about how many people are actually trained and active hazardous material technicians. I have hazmat tech training. Others have had that. That doesn't mean we've used it or that we respond to things on any regular basis. So true hazmat teams with that functional capability to respond this moment with the right tools, the right training, and the right resource is a little bit thinner than some thought.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I think that we also talked about regionalizing both the response capability, but also talking about the training. It is very difficult to get people from small rural areas to have to travel for a day, take a week or two of training, time off to do training,
yeah,
and then travel back. So there was some discussion about, does some of that training need to be more regionalized, or is there a method to make people aware of where training's at?
How about more training where it's online, where you can do self-paced, modularized, high quality training that you don't need to be in person?
Training online. Now, I've been training online, teaching online for about 20 years. AMU is an online university.
Okay.
And I think there's absolute value in education online and training online. It doesn't negate the hands-on need. I certainly don't want someone doing CPR.
I 100% agree. There's never going to be a time where you completely eliminate in-person, real hands-on, practical training, right?
Right. So I equate it with knowledge, skills, and ability. Knowledge is what you get in college. Skills are what you get in training and repetitive training. That's good for online for the predominant. It's that ability section.
Yeah.
Being able to demonstrate and repetitively demonstrate mastering of the skills that serves to qualify that ability section of your qualification, so to speak.
ET Nation, thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back after this message. Did you know E-Tank is the only environmental rental equipment company in the industry that offers a 100% certified clean guarantee at no additional cost? Well, this gives customers the peace of mind knowing that container contents from the previous renter isn't going to cross-contaminate the contents of the current customer and potentially cause liability concerns. You know, E-Tank also provides a one-of-a-kind complete maintenance program for all its rental items, including liquid-tight roll-off containers, fluid transfer pumps, and filtration system components. To learn more about the types of containers and pumps E-Tank supplies, check out their website at www.etank.net. So the next time you are faced with an environmentally challenging project, give E-Tank a call to help solve your problem. It's just that easy.
Do you feel like the industry is maybe could benefit from like an industry credential in the rail response or emergency response arena? And I'm coming from the perspective of, I'm a certified hazardous material manager, a CHMM. And so I have a pretty solid level of understanding of DOT and RCRA and all the hazmat requirements and things like that. But I'm not probably as well versed in the rail response side of the things, right? And there's a lot of crossover, but also specific things I need to know that if that was developed into a better, consistent awareness training, maybe you could develop a credential. Does that make sense or no?
I understand the value of credential, and I'd be remiss and get criticized. I actually sit on a committee at the International Association of Emergency Managers that is looking at and encouraging credentialing nationally.
Okay.
IAEM does in fact have a credential program. It's called the Certified Emergency Manager or Associate Emergency Manager, depending on where you're at in your career and what your background is. What I think though is credentialing is very valuable. It's up to each state to determine right now whether or not they want someone to be a credential. And right now it's up to employers.
Yeah, more it's volunteer, really, at this point, right?
So every credential, and this is coming from the academic world, any credential is only as good as the industry or element that accepts it. So if there is state legislation that starts to look at, before you handle a high-pressure rail car, you must have attended, and I don't like hours as much as skill set,
yeah,
but until you've demonstrated competency to put a cap on, you can't really respond.
Right.
We don't want to be your internship.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I think that's valid. Whether it should be a licensing is where I'm not comfortable yet one way or the other.
Okay. I think there's some more opportunity to explore that conversation and discussion amongst this body of leaders, thought leaders, because what I've heard is some people think, yes, this could be very beneficial, at least at a general basic overall competency level. And then when you need to specifically train on, like you said, fire response or dealing with a tank fire and depressurizing, that's going to be very specific compared to other levels of training.
Well, right? Think about it, though. We wouldn't let a firefighter fight an airplane fire unless they're an AR firefighter.
Right.
We wouldn't let a firefighter do a marine vessel firefighting unless they had some skill set or knowledge of the marine environment. Why would it be any different in railway to get someone validated? If they have a rail going through their town, if it is a hazard identified with a proper profile, then why not go through that training?
Yeah.
Where I think there's value is stacking of credentialing.
There you go.
If I'm going to bring somebody through a 16-hour training, let's just generically 16, whatever, hours of training on rail car safety, why not add the components that are necessary so that they meet the requirement for awareness refresher, operational refresher? So that this way they've met their annual requirement and got something new,
right?
Rather than the generic class they get every year.
Totally agree. Yeah, and then I think there's an attractive benefit to it that if the industry started to say, "Hey, I recognize this credential," if my responders or my staff obtain this, they're going to get a little benefit out of it. They're going to get a little bump in pay raise, or it's an elevation in status, something like that, where now it becomes also an opportunity to do staff retention because they're going to be like, I got to get to that next level. And if I get there, then I'll have this better position. I think there's could be some benefits in that space too.
I think in general, staff retention is an issue systemic right now.
Right.
And I think that you have to pay attention to what the needs are of your teams, your personnel. And training is always a valuable asset.
Yeah.
Everybody's nervous because, well, if I train you, then you'll move. If I train you and take you right, may I take care of you correctly, you're going to stay.
Right.
Because you have that loyalty and partnership. And I think that's very valuable. And it will also build, by the way, the more I can retain people, then the more I can retain a subject matter expertise relevant to my industry or my tools and resources and utilization.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that the Rail Hazmat Thought Leadership Summit here has been fantastic. I've met a lot of individuals. One individual that I didn't anticipate to come across was the 911 manager. And what she is involved with, she is like literally the first line of defense. And she says, this is the first time I've been invited to sit at the table and participate in this group. And she's the one advising the actual emergency responders with the initial information so they can go out and respond, and her not being involved, or not really like her, but specifically with that organization. I thought it was really interesting that this group was able to bring that group here and give them a seat and recognize them as a valuable asset and piece of the whole response.
We also talk about there are two elements that you're going to meet the moment you have an incident. The citizen responder, whoever's around you,
yep,
and the 911 operator is taking that call. That public safety telecommunicator is the public safety agency's initial intelligence,
yeah,
or information so that we could build a common operating picture and understand what's going on. It is that dispatcher or public safety telecommunicator, I'm old school, I still say dispatcher, that is going to assign the resources and services to support that response operation.
Right.
That can't be ignored. That matter of fact, that has to be an absolute scripted, coordinated information gathering so that I know what I'm responding to, what resources I need, and what potential problems I might face on the field.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so I'm glad they were here. That was another, I didn't know. I didn't even think about them, but I'm glad they're here. What are some of the takeaways that you're going to see or that you've identified that you're going to go back and take back to your work?
Well, as I said, there are two things. One of the things that I want to look at is local emergency planning councils and how can we better train emergency managers to build that component or local emergency planning committee, and go back and build how we're going to build or train emergency managers to build those capabilities, because they are a force multiplier. They increase the community's capability and reach of that emergency manager. The second thing is, I want to go back and look at the way we do THIRAs, at least my consulting side does THIRAs, threat hazard assessments, so that we can look at and see if rail corridor studies or commodity studies would give us additional information in defining the threat profile in the community.
Oh, that's great. I think one outcome of the conference, the summit here, is the, you know, what's the next steps? And there's been some recommendations that, you know, we should do another event at some point. Don't know when, how soon, whatever, but meet back up and let's report on some of the things that we have implemented and some of the successes, and then the continued dialogue and communication between the various parties that are involved in this. I think that would be a really good outcome. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And bringing your perspective. And it's been very interesting. And I'm learning a lot. And I know our listeners are learning a lot. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to thank our guest, Anthony Mangieri, for coming onto the show today. If you want to learn more about Anthony and the work he's doing to help communities prepare for emergencies, check out their website at www.mangierigroup.com. We'll also put a link to Anthony's contact information on my website. To listen to future Environmental Transformation podcasts, you can check us out on all the major podcast networks or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. And remember, don't forget to follow us and write a review about this episode. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel. Well, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.